supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Working.
Great movie, 9 to 5, with Molly Parton and a wonderful cast about, office politics. And that's what today's show's about. You know, there's more to being successful than just getting the job done, although any of you who works in an office probably already knows that. It's about how well you get along with your colleagues and your higher-ups and what you're willing to do to advance yourself. On today's show, we're going to talk about what office politics really are, how to get by, through, and work with them in today's, I think, increasingly politicized workplace. My guests are Ron Hill and Marilyn Pewter York. Ron's here in the studio with us. He's a senior associate dean and professor at Villanova University School of Business. Marilyn Pewter York is joining us by phone from New York City. She's a psychologist, executive coach, and author of The Office Survival Guide. Welcome to both of you to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's Marilyn.
Stay with us. After the show, we're going to be doing something that we haven't done before. We're going to have a web chat. Ron is able to stay with us after the show, and you can log in and chat with us further at WHYY.org/voices. But in the meantime, we want to hear from you. Give us a call. I trust anybody out there who works or has worked in an office has something to say about politics. Our number is 888-477-9499. Marilyn, let's start with you. One of the ways you define politics is that it involves trying to get where you want and being able to navigate other human beings and their and their personalities. Now, you know, you can look at that in a dispassionate way and say, well, we're social animals, that's what we do, that's how we get to where we need to go. But another could see it as pretty cynical and depressing.
I love the question. By the way, nice to meet you, Dan.
Ah, you too.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think it's really cynical. I think it's realistic. And I think there are those who hear the word politics and they cringe and they think that it's a bad thing. But I think when you define it in language that's positive, which is it is about relationships, as you pointed out at the outset, and it really is about adapting and being capable of being adaptive to changes in your work environment, which happen, you know, often out of your own control, I think it sounds like we're talking about resiliency, and it almost sounds like a more positive attribute, and being resilient is part of being smart politically in an environment.
Well, you know, it's interesting listening to you talk, Marilyn. You know, parenting is about manipulating relationships, and being an effective child is about successfully manipulating your parents, something I was particularly good at.
And even
psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're manipulative relationships.
But those, for whatever reasons, emotions get triggered. And it's almost acceptable for them to get triggered when you're the parent. Not when you're the therapist, clearly, but when you're the parent or you're the child, because it's an intimate relationship. The good news about being a therapist is it teaches you how to detach from your emotional reaction so that you can better serve your patient or your client, and that's kind of the job that employees need to learn.
I want to get to that in more detail. Let's unpackage this business of office politics. I want to, Ron, turn to you and understand what it is, why it's there, why we need it.
Well, thanks, Dan, and I really enjoyed what Marilyn had to say. I think organizational politics kind of wax and wane in an organization, and they wax and wane according to lots of things. One is the level of stress in the organization. If the place is under increasing amounts of stress, people are looking at ways to cope with it, as you well know, and they cope with it in ways that they hope will not hurt their performance on the job, so they seek other avenues to allow themselves to let off steam, and a lot of times that happens with their colleagues outside of the work environment or on one-on-one conditions, and it particularly becomes problematic in times when the leadership in an organization stops giving real information to people. Mm-hmm. And we look at a time like now. I was listening to the mayor earlier on your show or on the previous show, and he was talking about laying off several hundred people at one time, and he's talking about trying to reduce the budget again. Now, usually what happens in those circumstances is managers don't know what to tell their people, but they're told to keep them working hard.
Mm-hmm.
So people lose trust in the normal channels of communication, and what happens is these gossip chains or the office politics begin to take over, and people get empowered. Oftentimes, it really don't have the power in the organization because they pretend that they have some kind of insights into what's going on.
What do you mean? Give us an example. People get empowered who shouldn't.
Well, I'll give you a good example. I was at a university once, and we had a very, very small raise pool because it was a difficult academic climate. And the thing that we were told to do was to not tell anybody how much they were going to be getting because we weren't giving out very much, and so we wanted to try to figure a way to do it without disturbing anybody. And so what happened was somebody in the finance department went out, and he figured out, you know, by triangulating across a number of salaries, how much raise was being given out. He figured out the amount, and then he spread it throughout the organization. And that's the worst possible way for it to happen. Another example is, I remember a crisis in one organization I was involved with. The crisis was a young person in the organization had been raped. And instead of coming out and becoming the clearinghouse for information, instead they stopped talking to the press and told everybody in the organization no longer to say anything. Well, what happened was they sent an email around telling people that. That went directly to the media, and then the individuals tried to conduct kind of an underground campaign to get information out because they weren't telling people inside as well as outside the organization.
So, you know, it's what we hear from PR firms about all these people who get into trouble, just get out and open up. And same for organizations. You have to get out and open up. It reminds me, Marilyn, when I was just a young family therapist, I studied the work of Murray Bowen, who was pure systems. And Murray Bowen said the smallest stable relationship is a three-person relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
when there's tension between the two,
mm-hmm.
at least the two of you can agree that third person is an idiot, and it diffuses the tension.
Dan, I'd like to make a, by the way, I appreciated your comments too, Ron, and I want to make a comment about that and trying to integrate a little bit of the, if you will, the individual approach to politics and the more business approach. I think, based on my experience, the more dysfunctional or toxic the climate of a culture is, based on what Ron said, which is increased anxiety, increased stress, and potentially not very effective leadership, or in fact maybe toxic leadership, what happens is there was widespread anxiety. And some people rise to the occasion, frankly, and really become masterful in terms of managing it and really being good role models. But a lot of people really don't. The worst comes out, okay? The angst comes out, insecurity comes out, and people start responding defensively. And that's really where you get the concept of politics. I think politics is generic. There's positive and negative, but that's where you see the most dysfunctional politics, which can really harm people, not only mentally, you know, physically, as well as their, you know, success on the job.
Well, I want to get back to the issue that I raised in the billboard in the opening of the show, that both of you have suggested that it's not about what you do necessarily. It's not about performance. But, and I'll turn to you, Marilyn, as a psychologist. I mean, we're taught, you know, from the beginning, most of us, by our families, by our culture, that, you know, you do the right thing and good things will happen. But that's not true.
No, it's not. It maybe was more true years ago, although probably never completely. I do think that we as teachers and professors and parents probably, because things are a little bit more rational when you're in school or at home, and that is that life is a meritocracy. And truly, it probably is until you're, I don't know, Ron, if you would agree with this, but maybe when you're past your low-level job and you're in middle level, it really becomes not just technical performance and the output, your task achievement. It really becomes, not at that point, your relational skills and your adaptation skills and your ability to, with your important stakeholders, whoever that might be, your seniors, your peers, customers, your reports, if you have people who report to you, you know, how you manage that, how you manage it and lead those relationships are going to be key to your success. Performance opens up in terms of criteria of success at a certain point, which many of us are not trained to do, or many of us not even aware that that's important until we get there.
Ron, you know, Marilyn said not trained to do. Where is any, are any of us trained to do that? I mean, you're a professor.
Well, I,
that's your job, pal.
Thank you. There are so many good comments, Dan. Your comments and Marilyn's comments. This should be a five-hour show, but let me try to shorten my remarks. Two things. One is, it's absolutely true that we learn a model from very early on that doesn't work. In fact, it becomes dysfunctional in organizations when you rise to a particular level. And that is, if I score well on an exam, my mother will say I'm a good boy. My teacher will say I'm a good boy. They'll put it up on the refrigerator, do something else. Then you reach a point, and I've written about this in my own research, when envy, jealousy, and other kinds of things take over, when doing well no longer serves your purpose. You have to do well within a particular range of doing well, not standing too much above your colleagues, not making your boss look bad. Mm-hmm. So the model, that early model that Marilyn was talking about, becomes dysfunctional at a particular stage. And I have this, when I give talks to managers, I often ask them, how many of you worked for somebody that you thought was a complete idiot? And I just say it open like that, and almost everybody will raise their hands. And then I'll say, and you know what? You're going to continue to work for people that are less qualified than you in many cases because you've not switched on to that other model. We don't do a good job, Dan, of training our students how to deal with organizational politics. But for the first time, I'm actually giving a talk to our graduate students. We have this hot topics thing we do with our MBA students now, where it's going to be built on the process of organizational politics. And I've worked with some folks that have talked about, when does that subjective measures of success and your ability to navigate the political system within your organization supersede a lot of those more objective measures of success? And when that happens, that's when the dysfunctions occur.
I'm listening to you, and I'm right at the crossroads between being fascinated and between wanting to call my doctor to increase my dose of medication.
I mean, well, you're my doctor.
Really, I mean, it's not just about what you do, but it's how you stand next to someone. So we have to be taught that it's about performance plus what? Humility and relationships and don't make a loud noise? How do we teach that to our kids? This is killing me here, Marilyn.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry it's killing you. I mean, there's a lot out there that can kill us, right, in terms of not only that, but other factors, too, in the world. Well, let me respond by saying, in the executive coaching space that I'm in, I see a lot of high-potential, high-performers who come to me either on their own or referred by their management because they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot for the very issues that we're really talking about now. So I think the whole executive coaching world out there is trying to deal with that issue. However, I love that Ron is beginning to or is having talks with his graduate students about this. I think my husband, who's a professor at Sacred Heart University, is also doing something similar. So I think that there is more that's going out there. But one of the things that I have seen is the executives who seem to be naturally gifted at this, you know, are come from families that really do a lot of entertaining, a lot of parties, or they're in team sports where they are exposed, if you will, to competition. As Ryan was mentioning before, there are some performers that are better than others, but they're in a team, so they kind of have to learn these lessons at an earlier age and kind of process this. So I think, you know, some of it's wiring, but I also think some of it is childhood experiences or adolescent experiences that give them a leg up, if you will, when they get into work.
You were just listening, if just tuning in, that was Marilyn Puter, a psychologist, executive coach, author of the Office Survival Guide. We're talking about office politics today with Marilyn and Ron Hill, senior associate dean and professor at Villanova's School of Business. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. If you've got experience with office politics or would like to comment on office politics, again, that's 888-477-9499. We've got several callers. We're going to get to you right after our break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Support for WHYY is provided by Abington Memorial Hospital, now offering a new program for men with elevated PSAs who may be at risk for prostate cancer. The Prostate Evaluation Program brings together a multidisciplinary team of physicians and specialists who review cases together, providing recommendations and action steps for each individual. For more information, 215-481-MALE or AMH.org. Abington Memorial Hospital, the power to heal.
Supporting WHYY, St. Joseph's University offers a Master's in Organization Development and Leadership. ODL provides immediately applicable and practical skills and helps advance a student's ability to influence and affect change through leadership. Information and registration for the March 9th Graduate Open House is available online at sju.edu/graduate. The Master's in ODL at St. Joseph's University. Spirit, intellect, purpose.
What right does Jim have to claim authority? Hmm? Is he as good a salesman as I? Come on!
Office politics, that's what you heard just now, and we're going to hear more about office politics today with Ron Hill. He's here in the studio with me, senior associate dean and professor at Villanova School of Business. We're joined on the phone by Marilyn Puter York, a psychologist, executive coach, and author of the Office Survival Guide. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Carol on the line. Carol, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I'm enjoying the show, as usual.
Me too.
And I have a quick question for you. I found that being a racial minority in corporate America is a little more difficult to navigate. A lot of times we are said to not be team players, and it is more due to, I would say, cultural differences in the things we do outside of work versus what's happening in the workplace and our performance in the workplace. And I just want to know how to get around that, because I find that a lot of African Americans specifically get frustrated at a certain level, and they stop growing, they stop moving in the workplace because of this.
Give us an example, Carol.
Well, I would say things like joining people for happy hour after work, you know, the type of bars you go to and the like. And then you decline, and then, you know, all of a sudden, well, you're not, you know, getting along with the group, and you're not exactly fitting into the group. You're getting comments like that from your management.
I want to take your question and expand it and have our experts comment, because, you know, you're talking about racial cultural issues, but it also touches on gender issues, of course. And so the question is, how much are you willing to do? What are you willing to give up to make this whole thing work? Marilyn, let's start with you.
No, I think that's you just put your finger on it, and that is you really have to understand the fit between yourself and the issues that come with your gender and the issues that come with your race, and or religion, frankly, or political, you know, point of view, and the fit between that and the overall culture, which is why I would hope people do more due diligence when they accept jobs and companies, because I think that sometimes there's going to be a mismatch, and the question really is, can you impact the culture? Or do you have to make the modifications in order to be a better fit? And I think the question is, you know, there's a point to which it becomes ethical, unethical to make that those changes. And I think that becomes a individual answer.
And personally, ethical or unethical. Not,
exactly.
not just ethics, but, you know.
No, I mean your, personal ethics.
Your own personal values.
Absolutely.
Ron?
Well, I think it's a fabulous question, and I remember I had a colleague who called me in to do a consulting project, and he said he had a manager who just wasn't fitting in, and he felt that this person just wasn't doing the job that he needed her to do. Well, she was the only vice president in this company that was a female. She was never invited to lunch. They would go out and have single malt scotch and cigars at night. And she could come, but she didn't like smoke, and she didn't want to drink that much. Then they would go out to the golfing range. She didn't golf. She played tennis. And so I think this is also what happens to a number of African Americans. But another, I say the larger problem is that in many cases, people don't know how to manage people of other genders and other races because they are overly sensitized to it, to the point where they don't give the kind of feedback you need in order to fit in. They don't tell you that, you know, I'm going here and I'm going to actually bring you with me and I'm going to stay with you and introduce you to people. Mm-hmm. They don't take the role of cross-gender, cross-race mentoring seriously. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, this person can feel very alienated.
Mm-hmm. You raised a question, and we'll focus in on Carol. I'm talking about you, Marilyn. You mm-hmm. raised a question, and let's, you know, use Carol as an example. You said that you talked about people changing culture.
Mm-hmm.
So what could Carol do to change the culture there?
Well, I think is it possible to change it completely? No, but is it possible to make a few steps in the direction? First of all, there are, it seems to me, organizations, and these are in large organizations, Carol, so I don't know if it fits in the organization you're in, that have diversity programs, you know, that have women's centers within companies. I mean, I know these things exist. And, you know, sometimes they exist in name only. Sometimes they truly are proactive in doing, like Ron said, having outreach to senior management in terms of sensitizing them and orient them to the kind of mentoring they need to do to help their whatever gender, race, the employee really better adapt, but also to, you know, change the way they operate. But they're also there to do mentoring. And these may be more senior leaders who have themselves or African-American or women or whatever is the issue at hand, who can do some mentoring. And sometimes through those steps of reaching out for assistance, to organizations like that within, or in fact there are professional organizations, one could find some tools to figure out how to better navigate within the organization.
Hmm. Carol?
Great ideas, but I think another concern of mine is also that this is often put on the individual as they have to change, they have to navigate.
Right.
Instead of looking at the system as a whole and saying there's something not right here, this person is doing a great job, they're interacting with their coworkers at work, why are they being held on these little things to stop their progress?
You know, it's a really good, I'll just briefly state that that is the problem, and we live in a litigious society, and so because a lot of this is crafted by attorneys who are trying to keep their executives out of trouble, they're almost more fearful of working with you, more fearful of giving you feedback than they would be otherwise. And you're right, it lays heavily upon you, even in organizations that say they're promoting diversity. And that's the problem. Everybody is saying that. How many are actually living it?
So who's responsible for diminishing that kind of hyper-reactivity, that hypersensitivity? Does Carol have a role to play in it? Does her supervisors, or does it just sit with the CEO?
Can I answer?
Yes,
you know, from my experience, it's multiple. It's all across the board. It's everyone and in every position. But Carol, one of the things that I help people do is what's in your control.
Right.
Because otherwise one can feel, not you, but someone in your role could feel like a victim of circumstances that are out of your control, and that only adds to helplessness, frustration, anger, whatever, and sadness, frankly. So since those are not the most positive feelings to experience and doesn't add to one's sense of resiliency in one's life or one's career, I think you have to look at it, and I'm sorry that I'm answering it this way, but I think it comes down to what's in your control. And pick those things that are in your control that you think can aid you in navigating the best way that you can, or educating in the best way you can, and learn how to do that in a diplomatic but assertive manner that helps people better understand what your needs are without alienating them. I know I would love to say that every CEO, before he becomes or she becomes a CEO, should go through sensitivity training. And then it top down, but unfortunately, that will take time.
But they need another kind of sensitivity training as well, don't you think, Dan? I mean, it seems to me that we go in and we put colored pebbles in a box or something. You know, that's one kind of sensitivity training. But I've been the only Caucasian in an entirely African American community in a business environment, and you begin to recognize that. You know what? I'm looking around, and no one looks like me. Now, fast forward that to our caller and other callers, where that's the life they'd lead so much of their lives, and we don't see it through their lenses. We see it very differently as managers from the majority race.
Yeah. Carol, I hope this discussion was helpful for you.
It was very good. Thank you.
Yeah, and I appreciate your call. I want to talk about gender here, now that we've talked about race and culture, it almost begs us to talk about gender. We've got Louise on the line, who I think has that question or comment. Louise?
Well, I have three daughters, and we have had several discussions about when they have to go to negotiate for an increase in salary or applying for a better position. They, in a sense, because of their gender, have always been, not the assertive one. They're the mediators, they're the caregivers, and so on. And they have mentioned that they don't know how to assert themselves without coming off in a negative manner. And, even to the point where, they talk to my husband, and, he's astonished that they even have to have such coaching. Because the guys, it almost comes naturally, or it comes from their, upbringing.
Yeah,
I'll take your comment offline, but I thought it ties in with the previous caller.
Yeah, we learned an awful lot about that in the last presidential primaries, didn't we? Marilyn?
Well, I do think that there are some people who come into the world with the wiring and the temperament, frankly, who are a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more assertive, and I've seen women who were like that when they were younger and who needed to be tamed down, in fact, because they were overly aggressive. So I do think there's a little bit of, biochemistry, DNA, and all that. And then depending upon the social environment and familial environment, depending upon the parental communications and school communications, and sports and all that, that also molds. And but I would say that in my experience, I have worked with women who are absolutely behaviorally and, mentally in that place where they're uncomfortable asserting themselves. It is, assuming it's not reflective of other psychological issues that involve being inhibited or, being fearful of failure and all the other things that might come with it, it is not that difficult to coach a woman or a very, very unassertive man to learn how to be assertive. It really is scripts and language that someone can use that doesn't alienate someone else, but allows for the other person to see the person's point of view and be motivated to give that person what that person is asking for. It is not that difficult.
Hmm. Ron, as a clinician, and as a clinician, I know that nothing grows without safety, that if there's no safety, growth halts. Can office politics ever be emotionally safe and promote growth, or is that an oxymoron? Ron, and I'll turn to you, Ron.
Yeah, I think it can, actually. I think there is value to office politics because in under the right conditions, it allows people to blow off steam without doing what Marilyn said, going in to an office environment, saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing just because you're angry. So if I'm upset about something at work and I go and talk to a friend of mine who I know I can be honest with, which means I can go and subjectively tell them about my day, then that's a good thing. Where it becomes dysfunctional, in my mind, is if leadership refuses to recognize that bad things happen and that negative things are happening to people. In other words, they don't give credence to the way which people are actually feeling at the job. And those people are also feeling as if they say what's true and what's really going on at the place, they're in jeopardy of losing their job. In that case, it means that the real conversation goes below the surface of the organization.
What can be done?
Well, I've coached is the wrong word because I'm not like Marilyn, but I've talked to a lot of managers about difficult times, and I tell them you need to inoculate people as to what's the worst that could happen and at least tell them in advance, you know, that this is what I see, this is the extent of my power and my knowledge, and you're going to get 100% of it. I'm going to tell you the reality of the good and the bad that's going on out there. And to try to control the flow of information using a formal scene rather than the informal scene. When they're viewed as not telling the truth, when they're viewed as trying to paint a rosy picture, when everyone realizes it doesn't exist, then people lose trust in them, and then that under the surface conversation, that office politics begins to have more power.
That's what we're talking about today on Voices in the Family. We're talking about office politics. You were just listening to Ron Hill. He's a senior associate dean and professor at Villanova School of Business. We're joined on the phone by Marilyn Pewter York, a psychologist, executive coach, and author of the Office Survival Guide. Our number is 888-477-9499. Believe it or not, we've got a couple of lines still open. So if you've got stories to tell about your office politics or questions about it, or if you're a CEO and would like to chime in, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to the Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Orchestra, under the baton of Christoph Eschenbach, commemorates the 200th birth anniversary of Robert Schumann with an evening devoted to this composer of romantic music, March 4th through 6th at the Kimmel Center. This all-Schumann program features Symphonies 2 and 4 and the Overture to the Bride of Messina. Tickets and information for the Philadelphia Orchestra by phone at 215-893-1999 or online at philorc.org.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents the world premiere exhibition Ancient Rome and America, now through August 1st. Showcasing the cultural, political, and social connections between ancient Rome and modern America, the exhibit features a never-before-seen collection of artifacts from Italy and the United States. Ancient Rome and America, now through August 1st at the National Constitution Center. Details at constitutioncenter.org.
Miranda, I can't.
If you don't go, I'll assume you're not serious about your future. At Runway or any other publication. The decision's yours.
Office politics. And that's what we... What do you say when your boss tells you to do something that does not feel ethical to you and your job or your future depends on it? These and many other questions are being answered today by Ron Hill, who's here in the studio with me, Associate Dean Professor at Villanova School of Business, and Marilyn Pewter York, who's a psychologist, executive coach, and author of the Office Survival Guide. Marilyn, you said earlier in the show that how we deal with office politics depends on our emotional reactions or really our lack thereof that we should use our brains, our cognition, rather than our emotion. But, you know, that makes sense, except working at the office is not just working at the office. It's about our literal survival, not our metaphorical survival. And that involves our limbic brains. That's mm-hmm. very emotional.
Throughout my whole book, what I talk about is there will be situations at work that will provoke emotion. They may be realistic situations that are, you know, provoking realistic emotion. You're afraid you're going to lose your job. You're demoted. You know, that makes you scared, angry, appropriate. There are situations that trigger you that maybe you have an irrational emotion to. You have a dominant boss who is being somewhat of a, you know, over-domineering boss, but not evil. And you feel like you want to, you know, strangle him or her because you come from a father or a mother who was similar, and therefore you have even in a more extreme reaction. My thesis is that you will feel, I'm not suggesting negating the feeling, I'm saying you need to process the feeling before you act on the feeling. Because often, if you act on, like, a feeling of anger, and you write that email in that moment when you're feeling it, and you send it, and that other person receives it, you may have turned that person into an enemy, so that the consequences of acting on your emotion without processing it, understanding how realistic it is, and depending upon that, you know, examination, if you will, then crafting a response that fits the situation and what you want to get out of the situation. See, what I'm suggesting is you're going to feel, but don't act on it without serious thought.
So it's okay to want to strangle your boss, but actually doing it wouldn't be your best idea.
In the extreme, but all the variations of the theme that involves, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you know what? I feel that way about my boss. I want to strangle him sometimes, and I'm self-employed, so you know that's a problem. That's a problem.
Well, we could have a whole other show on that.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Rob on the line. Hi, Rob.
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Well, I work with a lot of executives in my office in an analyst position, and I know that if I work closer with them socially, I could probably move up into maybe like a higher pay grade or a higher position, but because I'm not at all interested in sports or going to like the bars or things that they go to, I feel like I'm kind of missing out. And my wife suggests that I try to feign it. I try to fake it a little bit or try to become interested in it. And mm-hmm. I just can't do that. And I just kind of want to know what some of the experts there might suggest that I could do.
I want to turn to you, Ron, because during our break, unfortunately, Marilyn, you can't schmooze mm-hmm. with us during breaks. But mm-hmm. but Ron said the one thing that we needed to talk about is how people progress from the bottom to the top, and I think this touches on it. So how does Rob do this?
You know, Rob, that's a really good question. And what's happening is there's a conflict between what you think is, here's my performance, and you should rate me on that performance, versus right. there's this larger set of criteria that are being imposed upon you, and it just doesn't feel right. And in fact, I think in some objective world that doesn't exist, it probably is not right. But what I'm going to suggest to you is to find a way to compartmentalize some of this. You know, I don't think you need to go out every weekend with these guys doing the things that they do or every time they go out to happy hour, but you need to find a way to do some of it. And I think you can do some of it without completely compromising your values, which mm-hmm. means you're not that involved in sports, you're not that interested in going out and doing this, but to do it often enough to be seen as part of that collective. And if you can put it in a place in your mind, what I do now is in my own schedule, I book these things into my schedule as if they were part of my job. And if you switch your frame a little bit to viewing it as part of your job, recognizing that mostly what you're doing is over here, it's good stuff, and you feel very competent in it. But then add this part in, because as you move up, it moves further and further away from the objective, more to the subjective, and it becomes increasingly about how you navigate the people in your organization than it does your ability to have some kind of portfolio of work.
Marilyn, let me turn to you, and I want to ask you, would I be naive if I suggested to Rob to go to these things that he thinks he doesn't like and be open? He might find something interesting. He might not like sports or you know, like we talked about before, single malt scotch, but he might find the mentality of the people who like it interesting. He might learn something about people and himself. Is that a naive thing to suggest?
No, it's not naive, and I absolutely loved Ron's answer. I mean, I would put, you know, very yellow all over that answer and carry it with me wherever I went. It's not what we want to do if we're not interested in sports or don't want to drink or whatever. You know, we can appreciate that that's not fair, that might be criteria for promotability kinds of things, but that's the real world, Rob, and I think that, you know, rather than, and I'm not saying you are, but rather generically being resistant to it or anticipating that you're going to have a bad time, I do think Dan is right. I think you kind of have to, maybe not like Ron said, not, you know, 100%, but in limited doses, go with an open mind. Go with, you know, what can I learn from this? You know, maybe there is something going on in the sports that have to do with teamwork or the way in which the guys talk about it. Might be learning more about how they're what they're motivated by, what they think is important. So go there kind of with a fine antenna, listening and observing. You may learn about the people that you really want to get closer with or learn how to work with. So absolutely, I would go, and I would go with an open mind and with thinking of it not just as a project, but as a learning opportunity.
Rob, thanks so much for your call. I do hope that was helpful.
That was very helpful. Thank you, everybody.
So, you know, one of the things we're learning is as anxiety goes up, stress goes up, politics goes up, and kindness goes down, compassion mm-hmm. goes down. So that's the case in today's world. The recession, of course, makes it worse. So what can people do? What can be done to make an organization less negative? I hear deafening silence.
We have this routine now, Marilyn, where you go first and I go second.
Oh,
so.
Okay, but I thought it was much more, you know, there are always two sizes. What can the individual do?
Right.
Yeah.
And there's what the organization can do, Ron, and I thought...
I'll do the organization, you can do the individual.
Right,
how's that?
Exactly.
I think you're dropping back and punting on this. Marilyn was just a right.
No. Well, but I think it's worth noting, Dan, because I think it's a very good comment. I think at the organizational level, if I'm trying to put the right management in place, I'm trying to get people who are, one, empathic. That means they're individuals who care deeply about other people. They make the best leaders in my mind. Mm-hmm. Two, they're honest. That doesn't mean they don't know how to navigate the politics and hold their voices when it's appropriate, but they deal with their people from an honest perspective, and that means that underground channel doesn't work the way it normally does. And then the third thing, this is always tested under stress. It's not tested under good times. And you will find that there is a natural tendency to withdraw under stress, when we actually ought to fight that. It's kind of the fight and flight. We ought to go out and be more proactive in the dialogue with people under difficult times in order to keep the negative politics from happening. But I'll defer to Marilyn on the individual.
Well, you know, I think they're merged, and it's very hard to separate chicken and the egg when it comes to the organization and the individual, because sometimes you can have these very good things start from grassroots, but I do believe, I really do believe, because I work within organizations and I worked for an organization running their mental health program worldwide for 10 years, is that it really is the top that sets the tone, the climate, and anxiety sometimes is a byproduct of the organization that you're in and the way they're communicating and the way they're leading and their lack of empathy or compassion towards the lack of resources and more workload and threat of loss of job and all the other things that come along with the response to the recession. But at the end of the day, if you work in an organization where that is the way senior leadership is, and you cannot, however magical you can be, make dents there, I think in your own individual life, in your own direct reports or peers, or even with your senior manager, you yourself could step up and be a more resilient person under anxiety and stress and find the positive side of the lemon, you know, make lemonade out of lemon. And whether it means being more collegial with your colleagues, being more empathetic with your teammate whose husband may be ill or family may have just, you know, work-life balance issues, maybe you can offer, if you have less of a burden, to be more helpful. I mean, there are ways that you can create more harmony and more of a positive environment in the face of the stress by some little actions that you can take each day.
Mm. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Paula on the phone. Paula?
Hi.
Hi, Paula.
Dr. Dan, thank you so much for your show. It's a great topic today. Your previous conversation is like a segue into what I want to talk about. I previously worked at a place where everything was performance-based. So how each individual worked, there was a sheet passed around, and everyone would see the employee's name, how many calls they took, how many appointments they made, whatever the work was needed. Everything was completely printed out. So it was like people pitting against each other instead of creating a team environment. And this led to really bad morale in the office. And there were people that maybe did a little better one day, or maybe some people did not so good, and then they would circle in red if you didn't do good. And it was just like we tried to explain this to our management, but they just could not comprehend. So the morale was so bad.
So what's the answer to that, Ron?
Well, you know, first of all, that kind of environment is probably the most stressful environment to work under. So I feel for you, and I feel your pain having done jobs like that. But I think management makes a great error in those situations. I think there are ways in which to cheerlead people without using a lot of stick. Mm-hmm. Because the stick doesn't often lead people to try more things. It usually causes them to be more conservative in what they do, to go to the tried and true, and to avoid things that actually, in the long run, are more effective for them. I would run out of an organization like that as fast as I could. But there are ways to hold people accountable in public environments and make them praiseworthy that doesn't necessarily denigrate everybody else and makes people strive.
Yeah, I would agree.
I hope that was helpful, Paula. There's a message both of you seem to be putting out, and that for politics to be healthy, people at the top have to be open, honest, caring for their employees and care for their employees' welfare. We had a show years ago with a CEO of a multinational firm that was traded on the stock exchange, and he said, "You know, I've got to worry about how they appraise me quarter by quarter,
mm-hmm.
or the organization goes down." He said, "I don't have time to worry about people's feelings. I don't care. I just want them to put out the product and keep the profits going up, or else I go down." And, you know, in a way it made sense, but, you know, in fact, the organization did go down because they all do. But in today's climate, you know, it's even more difficult to look at the kinds of bottom lines you're talking about humanity and humility and kindness. Who's got time for that when we're worried about the next meal?
May I respond to that?
Yeah.
Dennis Marilyn, I think Ron could probably underscore this too, and maybe even with more experience. I think you can, in fact, attach costs to the mishandling of your human capital in terms of turnover, in terms of excessive downsizing, so that you wind up having to do more training, for the people who have either, you know, left because of the hardship of working in an organization that has no soul, if you will, or the getting rid of too many people as a short-term maneuver and then winding up when business circumstances change, having to spend even more money on training and retention. So I think there are some decisions that are made towards human capital that wind up costing more, but they have to be able to be shown, you know, in terms of the cost, you know, the cost-benefit of the importance of treating human capital in a dignified manner.
Interesting. Ron, you want to...
Well, I want to give Marilyn an amen. It's absolutely true, and I think it's much harder to build a great organization than it is to lose good people. And if you put them under those kinds of guns, who are the people that are going to flee ship first? It's your best, most marketable people are going to leave. So you create a negative environment you think is focused on trying to get things done. You end up with an Enron. You really do. You end up with an organization that will not admit when there are problems, will try to hide, sweep them under the table, and eventually they're going to get caught. I think honest communication makes a difference. And if you want to keep a good workforce, you've got to treat them like people that you care about. Otherwise, all they're there is for the dollar. And if it's that, somebody offers them a dollar more an hour, they're gone.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this paternalism and anxiety is not a good approach to get people involved. But, you know, gentle leadership and compassion really gets everybody pulling the oar in the same way. Last comment. We've only got couple seconds left.
I think there's some words that convey kind of a negative image, and that is politics is not bad. It's neutral. It can be good. It can be bad. I also think that gentle leadership has a kind of an approach. It sounds weak, okay?
Yeah.
And I would say wise leadership that takes into account the importance of having a highly motivated, empowered workforce.
We will let that word be wisdom. I think it's a better word. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been a great show. Marilyn, you've been wonderful. Will you come back?
Absolutely. It'd be my pleasure.
Marilyn is a psychologist, and Marilyn Pewter York wrote The Office Survival Guide. Ron, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure, Dan.
It was fun being with you. It was a fun show.
Thank you.
Ron Hill is with the Villanova University School of Business. Ron's going to stay on after the show. We're going to do a web chat. So if you've got comments or questions, you can find us at whyy.org/voices. Next week, Mike and Scott will be talking about the new diagnostic and statistical manual. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You've been enjoying